Who might you be? He asked.
Me, said Richard. Me? My name is Richard. Richard Mayhew.
Me?
Squeaked the fool, in an elderly, rather theatrical imitation of Richard's Scottish accent.
Me? Me? La nuncle, 'tis not a man, but a mooncalf.
The courtiers sniggered dustily. And I, de Carabas told the jester, with a blinding smile, call myself the Marquis de Carabas. The fool blinked.
De Carabas the thief? Asked the jester. De Carabas the body snatcher? De Carabas the traitor?
He turned to the courtiers around them.
But this cannot be de Carabas. For why? Because de Carabas has long since been banished from the Earl's presence. Perhaps it is instead a strange new species of stoat who grew particularly large.
The courtiers tittered uneasily, and a low buzz of troubled conversation began. The Earl said nothing, but his lips were pressed together tightly, and he had begun to tremble. I am called Hunter, said Hunter to the jester. The courtiers were silent then. The jester opened his mouth as if he were going to say something, and then he looked at her and he closed his mouth again. A hint of a smile played at the corner of Hunter's perfect lips. Go on, she said. Say something funny. The jester stared at the trailing toes of his shoes, then he muttered, My hound hath no nose. The Earl, who had been staring at the Marquis de Carabas like a slow-burning fuse, pop-eyed, white-lipped, unable to believe the evidence of his senses, now exploded to his feet, a grey-bearded volcano, an elderly berserker. His head brushed the roof of the carriage. He pointed at the Marquis and shouted, spittle flying,
I will not stand for it. I will not. Make him come forward.
Halvard waggled a gloomy spear at the Marquis, who sauntered to the front of the train until he stood, beside door, in front of the Earl's throne. The wolfhound growled in the back of its throat.
You,
said the Earl, stabbing the air with a huge knotted finger.
I know you, de Carabas. I haven't forgotten. I may be old, but I haven't forgotten.
The Marquis bowed. Might I remind your grace, he said urbanely, that we had a deal. I negotiated the peace treaty between your people and the Raven's Court, and in return, you agreed to provide a little favour.
So there is a Raven's Court, thought Richard.
He wondered what it was like.
A little favour, said the Earl.
He turned a deep beetroot colour.
Is that what you call it? I lost a dozen men to your foolishness in the retreat from White City. I lost an eye.
And if you don't mind my saying so, Your Grace, said the Marquis graciously, that is a very fetching patch. It sets off your face perfectly.
I swore, fulminated the Earl, beard bristling. I swore that if you ever set foot in my domain, I would...
He trailed off, shook his head, confused and forgetful. Then he continued,
It'll come back to me. I do not forget.
He might not be entirely pleased to see you, whispered Dor to de Carabas.
Well, he's not,
he muttered back. Dor stepped forward once more.
Your Grace, she said loudly, clearly. De Carabas is here with me as my guest and my companion.
For the fellowship there has ever been between your family and mine, for the friendship between my father and...
He abused my hospitality, boomed the Earl. I swore that if he ever again entered my domain, I would have him gutted and dried, like something that's been,
gutted first, and then, dried.
Perchance a kipper, my lord?
Suggested the jester. The earl shrugged.
It is of no matter. Guards, seize him.
And they did. While neither of the guards would ever see 60 again, each of them was holding a crossbow, pointed at the marquee, and their hands did not tremble, neither with age nor fear. Richard looked at Hunter. She seemed untroubled by this, watching it almost with amusement, like someone watching a piece of drama played out for their benefit. Dor folded her arms and stood taller, putting her head back, raising her pointed chin. She looked less like a ragged street pixie, more like someone used to getting her own way. The opal eyes flashed.
Your Grace, the Marquis is with me as my companion on my quest. Our families have been friends for a long time now.
Yes, they have, interrupted the Earl helpfully. Hundreds of years. Hundreds and hundreds. Knew your grandfather, too. Funny old fellow. Bit vague, he confided.
But I am forced to say that I will take an act of violence against my companion as an act of aggression against myself and my house.
The girl stared up at the old man. He towered over her. They stood for some moments, frozen. He tugged on his red and grey beard agitatedly, then he thrust out his lower lip like a small child.
I will not have him here, he said.
The Marquis took out the golden pocket watch he had found in Portico's study. He examined it carelessly. Then he turned to Dor and said, as if none of the events around them had occurred,
My lady, I will obviously be of more use to you off this train than on, and I have other avenues to explore.
No, she said. If you go, we all go.
I don't think so, said the Marquis.
Hunter will look after you as long as you stay in London below. I'll meet you at the next market. Don't do anything too stupid in the meantime. The train was coming into a station.
Dor fixed the Earl with her look.
There was something more ancient and powerful in those huge opal-coloured eyes in their pale heart-shaped face than her young years would have seemed to allow. Richard noticed that the room fell quiet whenever she spoke.
"Will you let him go in peace, Your Grace?" she asked.
The Earl ran his hands over his face, rubbed his good eye and his eye patch, then looked back at her.
"Just make him go," said the Earl.
He looked at the Marquis.
"Next time,"
he ran a thick old finger across his Adam's apple.
"Kipper."
The Marquis bowed low.
"I'll see myself out," he said to the guards, and stepped toward the open door.
Halvard raised his crossbow, pointed it toward the Marquis's back. Hunter reached out her hand and pushed the end of the crossbow back down toward the floor. The Marquis stepped onto the platform, turned and waved an ironic goodbye flourish at them. The door hissed closed behind him. The Earl sat down on his huge chair at the end of the carriage. He said nothing. The train rattled and lurched through the dark tunnel.
"Where are my manners?" muttered the Earl to himself.
He looked at them with one staring eye. Then he said it again in a desperate boom that Richard could feel in his stomach like a bass drumbeat.
"Where are my manners?"
He motioned one of the elderly men-at-arms to him.
They will be hungry after their journey, Dagvard. Thirsty, too, I shouldn't wonder.
Yes, Your Grace.
Stop the train, called the Earl.
The doors hissed open, and Dagvard scuttled off onto a platform. Richard watched the people on the platform. No one came into their carriage. No one seemed to notice that anything was at all odd, or in any way unusual. Dagvard walked over to a vending machine on the side of the platform. He took off his helmet. Then he rapped, with one mailed glove, on the side of the machine, "Orders from the Earl," he said. "Chocolates." A ratcheting whir came from deep in the guts of the machine, and it began to spit out dozens of Cadbury's fruit and nut chocolate bars, one after another. Dagvard held his metal helmet below the opening to catch them. The doors began to close. Halvard put the handle of his pike between the doors, and they opened again and began bumping open and shut on the pike handle. "Please stand clear of the doors," said a loudspeaker voice. "The train cannot leave until the doors are all closed." The Earl was staring at Dor lopsidedly, with his one good eye.
"So, what brings you here to me?" he asked.
She licked her lips. "Well, indirectly, Your Grace, my father's death." He nodded slowly.
"Yes, you seek vengeance. Quite right, too."
He coughed, then recited in a basso profundo,
"Brave the battling blade, flashes the furious fire, steel sword sheathed in hated heart, crimsons the something."
"Yes." "Vengeance?" Dor thought for a moment. "Yes, that was what my father said. But I just want to understand what happened and to protect myself. My family had no enemies." Dagvard staggered back onto the train then, his helmet filled with chocolate bars and cans of Coke. The doors were permitted to close, and the train moved off once more. Lear's coat, still on the floor of the tunnel, was covered in coins and banknotes now. But it was also covered with shoes. Shoes worn on feet. Shoes which were kicking the coins, smearing and tearing the banknotes, ripping the fabric of the coat. There was money underfoot, and no one seemed to notice. Lear had begun to cry. "Please, why won't you leave me alone?" he begged. He was backed against the wall of the passage. Blood ran down his face and dripped crimson into his beard. His saxophone hung limply, awkwardly, on his chest, dented and scraped. He was surrounded by a small crowd of people, more than 20, less than 50. Every one of them shoving and pushing in a mindless mob, their eyes blank and staring, each man and woman fighting and clawing in order desperately to try and give Lear their money. There was blood on the tiled wall where Lear had knocked his head. Lear flailed out at one middle-aged woman, her purse wide open, a fistful of £5 notes thrust out at him. She clawed at his face in her eagerness to give him her money. He twisted to avoid her fingernails and fell to the tunnel floor. Someone trod on his hand. His face was pushed into a slurry of coins. He began to sob and to curse.
"I told you not to overuse it," said an elegant voice nearby.
"Naughty."
"Help me,"
gasped Lear.
"Well, there is a countercharm," admitted the voice, almost reluctantly.
The crowd was pressing closer now. A flung 50-pence coin opened Lear's cheek. He curled into a fetal ball, hugging himself, burying his face in his knees.
"Play it, damn you," sobbed Lear. "Whatever you want, just make them stop."
A penny whistle piping began softly and echoed down the passage. A simple phrase, repeated over and over, slightly different every time, the De Carabas variations. The footsteps were moving away, shuffling at first, then picking up pace, moving away from him. He opened his eyes. The Marquis De Carabas was leaning against the wall, playing the penny whistle. When he saw Lear looking at him, he took the whistle from his lips, replaced it in an inside pocket of his coat. He tossed Lear a lace-edged handkerchief of patched linen. Lear wiped the blood from his forehead and face.
"They would have killed me," he said accusingly.
"I did warn you,"
said De Carabas. "Just count yourself lucky I was coming back this way." He helped Lear into a sitting position.
"Now," he said,
I think you owe me another favour. Lear picked up his coat, torn and muddy, and imprinted with the marks of many feet, from the passage floor. He suddenly felt very cold, and he wrapped the shredded coat around his shoulders. Coins fell and notes fluttered to the floor. He let them lie. Was I really lucky, or did you set me up? The Marquis looked almost offended. I don't know how you could even bring yourself to think such a thing. 'Cause I know you, that's how. So what is it this time? Theft? Arson? Lear sounded resigned and a little sad. And then, murder? De Carabas reached down and took back his handkerchief. Theft, I'm afraid. You were right the first time, he said with a smile. I find myself in rather urgent need of a piece of Tang Dynasty sculpture. Lear shivered. Then, slowly, he nodded. Richard was handed a bar of vending machine-sized Cadbury's fruit and nut chocolate and a large silver goblet ornamented around the rim with what appeared to Richard to be sapphires. The goblet was filled with Coca-Cola. The jester, whose name appeared to be Thule, cleared his throat loudly.
I would like to propose a toast to our guests, he said. A child, a bravo, a fool. May they each get what they deserve.
Which one am I?
Whispered Richard to Hunter.
The fool, of course, she said. In the old days, said Halvard dismally after sipping his coke, we had wine. I prefer wine. It's not as sticky.
Do all the machines just give you things like that? Asked Richard.
Oh, yes, said the old man. They listen to the Earl, you see. He rules the underground, the bit with the trains. He's lord of the Central, the Circle, the Jubilee, the Victorious, the Bakerloo, well, all of them except the Underside line.
What's the Underside line? Asked Richard.
Halvard shook his head and pursed his lips.
Hunter brushed Richard's shoulder with her fingers.
Remember what I told you about the shepherds of Shepherd's Bush? You said I didn't want to meet them, and there were some things I was probably better off not knowing.
Good, she said. So now you can add the underside line to the list of things you're better off not knowing.
Dor came back down the carriage toward them. She was smiling. The Earl's agreed to help us, she said. Come on, he's meeting us in the library. Richard was almost proud of the way he didn't say, what library, or point out that you couldn't put a library on a train. Instead, he followed Dor toward the Earl's empty throne, and round the back of it, and through the connecting door behind it, and into the library. It was a huge stone room, with a high wooden ceiling. Each wall was covered with shelves. Each shelf was laden with objects. There were books, yes, but the shelves were filled with a host of other things. Tennis rackets, hockey sticks, umbrellas, a spade, a notebook computer, a wooden leg, several mugs, dozens of shoes, pairs of binoculars, a small log, six glove puppets, a lava lamp, various CDs, records, LPs, 45s and 78s, cassette tapes and eight tracks, dice, toy cars, assorted pairs of dentures, watches, flashlights, four garden gnomes of assorted sizes, two fishing, one of them mooning, the last smoking a cigar, piles of newspapers, magazines, grimoires, three-legged stools, a box of cigars, a plastic nodding head Alsatian, socks. The room was a tiny empire of lost property.
This is his real domain, muttered Hunter. Things lost. Things forgotten.
There were windows set in the stone wall. Through them, Richard could see the rattling darkness and the passing lights of the underground tunnels.
The Earl was sitting on the floor, with his legs splayed, patting the wolfhound and scratching it underneath the chin. The jester stood beside him, looking embarrassed. The Earl clambered to his feet when he saw them, his forehead creased.
"Ah, there you are. Now there was a reason I asked you here. It'll come to me."
He tugged at his red-grey beard, a tiny gesture from such a huge man. "The Angel Islington, Your Grace," said Dore politely.
"Oh, yes. Your father had a lot of ideas, you know. Ask me about them. I don't trust change. I sent him to Islington."
He stopped, blinked his one eye.
"Did I tell you this already?"
"Yes, Your Grace. And how can we get to Islington?" He nodded as if she had said something profound.
"Only once by the quick way. After that you have to go the long way down. Dangerous,"
Dore said patiently. "And the quick way is?"
"Oh, no, no. I need to be an opener to use it. Only good for Portico's family."
He rested a huge hand on her shoulder. Then his hand slid up to her cheek.
"Better off staying here with me. Keep an old man warm at night, eh?"
He leered at her and touched her tangle of hair with his old fingers. Hunter took a step toward Dore. Dore gestured with her hand. "No, not yet." Dore looked up at the Earl and said, "Your Grace, I am Portico's oldest daughter. How do I get to the Angel Islington?" Richard found himself amazed that Dore was able to keep her temper in the face of the Earl's obviously losing battle with temporal drift. The Earl winked his single eye in a solemn blink, an old hawk, his head tipped on one side. Then he took his hand from her hair.
So you are, Portico's daughter. How is your dear father? Keeping well, I hope. Fine man, good man.
How do we get to the Angel Islington?" said Dore, but there was a tremble in her voice.
Oh, I use the Angelus, of course."
Richard found himself imagining the Earl, 60, 80, 500 years ago, a mighty warrior, a cunning strategist, a great lover of women, a fine friend, a terrifying foe. There was still the wreckage of that man in there somewhere. That was what made him so terrible and so sad. The Earl fumbled on the shelves, moving pens and pipes and pea-shooters, little gargoyles and dead leaves. Then, like an aged cat stumbling on a mouse, he seized a small, rolled-up scroll and handed it to the girl.
"Here you go, lassie," said the Earl. "All in here. And I suppose we'd better drop you off where you need to go."
"You'll drop us off?" asked Richard. "In a train?" The Earl looked around for the source of the sound, focused on Richard, and smiled enormously.
"Oh, think nothing of it," he boomed. "Anything for Portico's daughter."
Dore clutched the scroll tightly, triumphantly. Richard could feel the train beginning to slow, and he and Dore and Hunter were led out of the stone room and back into the carriage. Richard peered out at the platform as they slowed down.
"Excuse me, what station is this?" he asked.
The train had stopped, facing one of the station signs. "British Museum," it said. Somehow, this was an oddity too many. He could accept the mind-the-gap thing, and the Earl's Court, and even the strange library. But damn it, like all Londoners, he knew his tube map, and this was going too far.
"There isn't a British Museum station," said Richard, firmly.
"There isn't," boomed the Earl. Then you must be very careful as you get off the train."
and he guffawed delightedly and tapped his jester on the shoulder.
Hear that, truly? I am as funny as you are.
The jester smiled as bleak a smile as ever was seen.
My sides are splitting, my ribs are cracking, and my mirth is positively uncontainable, Your Grace, he said.
The doors hissed open. Doris smiled up at the earl. Thank you, she said.
Off, off, said the vast old man, shooing Doris and Richard and Hunter out of the warm, smoky carriage onto the empty platform.
And then the doors closed, and the train moved away, and Richard found himself staring at a sign which, no matter how many times he blinked, nor even if he looked away from it and looked back suddenly to take it by surprise, still obstinately persisted in saying, British Museum. Chapter 8. It was early evening, and the cloudless sky was transmuting from royal blue to a deep violet, with a smudge of fire orange and lime green over Paddington, 4 miles to the west where, from Old Bailey's perspective anyway, the sun had recently set. Skies, thought Old Bailey, in a satisfied sort of a way. Never are two of them alike. Not by day, nor not by night neither. He was a bit of a connoisseur of skies, was Old Bailey, and this was a good un. The old man had pitched his tent for the night on a roof opposite St. Paul's Cathedral, in the centre of the City of London. He was fond of St. Paul's, and it, at least, had changed little in the last 300 years. It had been built in white Portland stone, which had, before it was even completed, begun to turn black from the soot and the filth in the smoky London air, and now, following the cleaning of London in the 1970s, it was more or less white again. But it was still St. Paul's. He was not sure that the same could be said for the rest of the City of London. He peered over the roof, stared away from his beloved sky, down to the sodium-lit pavement below. He could see security cameras affixed to a wall, and a few cars, and one late office worker locking a door and then walking toward the tube. Brrr! Even the thought of going underground made Old Bailey shudder. He was a roof man, and proud of it, had fled the world at ground level so long ago. Old Bailey remembered when people had actually lived here in the city, not just worked. When they had lived and lusted and laughed, built ramshackle houses, one leaning against the next, each house filled with noisy people. Why, the noise and the mess and the stinks and the songs from the alley across the way, then known, at least colloquially, as Shitton Alley, had been legendary in their time. But no one lived in the city now. It was a cold and cheerless place of offices, of people who worked in the day and went home to somewhere else at night. It was not a place for living any more. He even missed the stinks. The last smudge of orange sun faded into nocturnal purple. The old man covered the cages, so the birds could get beauty sleep. They grumbled, then slept. Old Bailey scratched his nose, after which he went into his tent and fetched a blackened stew pot, some water, some carrots and potatoes, and salt, and a well-hanged pair of dead-plucked starlings. He walked out onto the roof, lit a small fire in a soot-blackened coffee can, and was putting his stew on to cook when he became aware that someone was watching him from the shadows by a chimney stack. He picked up his toasting fork and waved it threateningly at the chimney stack.
"Who's there?"
The Marquis de Carabas stepped out of the shadows, bowed perfunctorily, and smiled gloriously. Old Bailey lowered his toasting fork.
"Oh," he said, "it's you. Well, what do you want? Knowledge or birds?"
The Marquis walked over, picked a slice of raw carrot from Old Bailey's stew, and munched it. "Information, actually," he said. Old Bailey chortled.
He said, "Here's a turn up for the books, eh?"
Then he leaned toward the Marquis.
"What'll you trade for it?"
"What do you need?"
Maybe I should do what you do. I should ask for another favour, an investment for one day down the road. Old Bailey grinned.
Much too expensive in the long run, said the Marquis, without humour. Old Bailey nodded. Now the sun had gone down. It was getting very cold, very fast.
Shoes, then, he said, and a balaclava helmet.
He inspected his fingerless gloves. They were more hole than glove.
And new gloveses. It's going to be a bastard winter.
Very well. I'll bring them to you. The Marquis de Carabas put his hand into an inside pocket and produced, like a magician producing a rose from thin air, the black animal figure he had taken from Portico's study. Now, what can you tell me about this? Old Bailey pulled on his glasses. He took the object from de Carabas. It was cold to the touch. He sat down on an air conditioning unit, then, turning the black obsidian statue over and over in his hand, he announced, "It's the great beast of London." The Marquis said nothing. His eyes flickered from the statue to Old Bailey, impatiently. Old Bailey, enjoying the Marquis's minor discomfort, continued at his own pace.
"Now, they say that back in First King Charlie's day, him has got his head all chopped off, silly bugger. Before the fire and the plague, this was, there was a butcher, lived down by the Fleet Ditch, and some poor creature he was going to fatten up for Christmas. Some says it was a piglet, and some says it wasn't, and there's some, and I list myself as one of them, that wasn't never properly certain. One night in December, the beast runned away, ran into the Fleet Ditch, and vanished into the sewers. And it fed on the sewage, and it grew, and it grew, and it got meaner and nastier. They'd send in hunting parties after it from time to time."
The Marquis pursed his lips.
"It must have died 300 years ago.
Old Bailey shook his head.
"Things like that, they're too vicious to die. Too old and big and nasty."
The Marquis sighed. "I thought it was just a legend," he said, "like the alligators in the sewers of New York City." Old Bailey nodded sagely.
"What, the big white buggers? They're down there. I had a friend lost a head to one of them."
A moment of silence. Old Bailey handed the statue back to the Marquis. Then he raised his hand and snapped it, like a crocodile head, at de Carabas.
"It was okay," gurned Old Bailey,
with a grin that was most terrible to behold.
"He had another."
The Marquis sniffed, uncertain whether or not Old Bailey was pulling his leg. He made the statue of the beast vanish inside his coat once more.
"Hang on,"
said Old Bailey. He went back inside his brown tent and returned, holding the ornate silver box the Marquis had given him on their previous meeting. He held it out to the Marquis.
"How about this, then?" he asked. "Are you ready to take it back? It fair gives me the creepy shivers, having it around."
The Marquis walked to the edge of the roof, dropped the 8 feet to the next building.
"I'll take it back when all this is over," he called. "Let us hope that you don't have to use it."
Old Bailey leaned over.
"How will I know if I do?"
"You'll know," called the Marquis, "and the rats will tell you what to do with it." And with that, he was slipping down the side of the building, using drain pipes and ledges as handholds.
"Hope I never finds out, that's all I can say," said Old Bailey to himself.
Then a thought struck him.
"Oi!"
he called out to the night and the city.
"Don't forget the shoeses and the gloveses."
The advertisements on the walls were for refreshing and health-giving malted drinks, for 2-shilling day excursions by train to the seaside, for kippered herrings, moustache wax, and bootblack. They were smoke-blackened relics of the late 20s or the early 30s. Richard stared at them in disbelief.
It seemed completely abandoned, a forgotten place. It is British Museum Station, admitted Richard. But there never was a British Museum Station. This is all wrong. It was closed down in about 1933 and sealed off, said Dor. How bizarre, said Richard. It was like walking through history. He could hear trains echoing through tunnels nearby, felt the push of air as they passed. Are there many stations like this? About 50, said Hunter. They aren't all accessible, though. Not even to us. There was a movement in the shadows at the edge of the platform. Hello, said Dor. How are you? She went down into a crouch. A brown rat stepped out into the light. It sniffed at Dor's hand. Thank you, said Dor cheerfully. I'm glad you aren't dead, too. Richard edged over. Dor, could you tell the rat something for me? The rat turned its head toward him. Miss Whiskers says that if there's anything you've got to say to her, you can tell it to her yourself, said Dor. Miss Whiskers? Dor shrugged. It's a literal translation, she said. It sounds better in rat. Richard did not doubt it. Hello, Miss Whiskers. Look, there was one of your rat speaker people, a girl named Anesthesia. She was taking me to the market. We were crossing this bridge in the dark, and she just never made it across. The rat interrupted him with a sharp squee. Dor began to talk, hesitantly, like a simultaneous translator. She says that the rats do not blame you for the loss. Your guide was taken by the night as tribute. But, the rat squeaked again. Sometimes they come back, said Dor. She has taken note of your concern and thanks you for it. The rat nodded to Richard, blinked her bead black eyes, then leapt to the floor and scurried back into the dark. Nice rat, said Dor. Her disposition seemed to have improved remarkably now she had the scroll. Up there, she said, indicating an archway effectively blocked by an iron door. They walked over to it. Richard pushed against the metal. It was bolted from the other side. Looks like it's been sealed up, said Richard. We'll need special tools. Dor smiled suddenly. Her face seemed to be illuminated. For a moment, her elfin face became beautiful. Richard, she said. My family. We're openers. It's our talent. Look. She reached out a grubby hand, touched the door. For a long moment, nothing happened. Then there was a loud crash from the other side of the door and a chunk from their side. Dor pushed against the door and, with a fierce squeal from the rusted hinges, it opened. Dor turned up the collar of her leather jacket and thrust her hands deep into the pockets. Hunter shone her flashlight into the blackness beyond the doorway, a flight of stone steps going up into the dark. Hunter, can you take the rear? Asked Dor. I'll go on in front. Richard can take the middle. She walked up a couple of steps. Hunter stayed where she was. Lady, said Hunter, you were going to London above? That's right, said Dor. We're going to the British Museum. Hunter bit her lower lip. Then she shook her head. I must stay in London below, she said. There was a tremble in her voice. Richard realized that this was the first time he had ever seen Hunter display any emotion other than effortless competence, or, occasionally, tolerant amusement. Hunter, said Dor, bewildered, you're my bodyguard. Hunter looked ill at ease. I am your bodyguard in London below, she said. I cannot go with you to London above. But you have to. My lady, I cannot. I thought you understood. The Marquis knows. Hunter will look after you as long as you stay in London below, thought Richard. Yes.
No,
said Dor, her pointed chin pushed out and up, her odd-coloured eyes narrowed.
I don't understand. What is it? She added scornfully. Some kind of curse or something?
Hunter hesitated, licked her lips, then nodded. It was as if she were admitting to having some socially embarrassing disease.
Look, Hunter, Richard heard his own voice saying, don't be silly.
For a moment he thought she was about to hit him, which would have been bad. Or even to start crying, which would have been much, much worse. Then she took a deep breath and said, in measured tones,
I will walk by your side when you are in London below, my lady, and I shall guard your body from all harm that might befall you. But do not ask me to follow you to London above. I cannot.
She folded her arms beneath her breasts, planted her legs a little apart, and looked for all the underworld like a statue of a woman not going anywhere, cast in brass and in bronze and in burnt caramel.
Right, said Dor. Come on, Richard.
And she set off up the steps.
Look, said Richard, why don't we stay down here? We can find the Marquis and then all set off together and...
Dor was disappearing into the darkness above him. Hunter was planted at the foot of the stairs.
I shall wait here until she returns, Hunter told him.
You may go or stay as you will. Richard chased up the steps as fast as he could in the dark. Soon he saw Dor's lamplight above him.
Wait! He panted. Please!
She stopped and waited for him to catch up. And then, when he had caught up and was standing next to her on a claustrophobically small landing, she waited for him to catch his breath.
You can't just go running off like that, said Richard.
Dor said nothing. The line of her lips became slightly more compressed. The angle of her chin was ever so slightly raised.
She's your bodyguard, he pointed out.
Dor began to walk up the next flight of steps. Richard followed her.
Well, we'll be back soon enough, said Dor. She can start guarding me again then.
The air was close, dank and oppressive. Richard wondered how you could tell if the air was bad in the absence of a canary, and contented himself with hoping that it wasn't.
I think the Marquis probably did know about her curse, or whatever it is, he said.
Yes, she said, I expect he did.
He, Richard began, the Marquis. Well, you know, to be honest, he seems a little bit dodgy to me.
Dor stopped. The steps dead-ended in a rough brick wall. She agreed.
He's a little bit dodgy in the same way that rats are a little bit covered in fur.
Then why go to him for help? Wasn't there someone else who could have helped you, someone else you could have sent me to find?
We'll talk about it later.
She opened the scroll the Earl had given her, glanced over the spidery, archaic handwriting, then rolled it back up.
We'll be fine, she said decisively. It's all in here. We've just got to get into the British Museum. We find the Angelus, we get out. Easy, nothing to it, a doddle.
Close your eyes. Richard closed his eyes obediently.
Nothing to it, he repeated. When people say that in films, it always means that something awful is going to happen.
He felt a breeze against his face, something in the quality of the darkness beyond his closed eyelids. Changed.
So what's your point?
Asked Dor. The acoustics had altered as well. They were in a bigger room.
You can open your eyes now.
He opened his eyes.
They were on the other side of the wall, he assumed, in what appeared to be a junk room.
Not just any old junk room, though. There was something rather strange and special about the quality of this junk. It was the kind of magnificent, rare, strange and expensive junk one would only expect to see somewhere like...
"Are we in the British Museum?" he asked. She frowned and seemed to be thinking or listening. "Not exactly. We're very near. I think this must be some kind of storage space or something." She reached up to touch the fabric of a suit of antique clothing displayed on a wax dummy. "I wish we'd stayed back with the bodyguard," said Richard. Dor tipped her head on one side, looked at him gravely. "And what do you need guarding from, Richard Mayhew?" "Nothing," he admitted. And then they turned the corner and he said, "Well, maybe them." And at the same time, Dor said, "Shit." The reason Richard said, "Maybe them," and the reason Dor said, "Shit," was this. Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandermeer were standing on plinths on each side of the aisle down which they walked. They reminded Richard horridly of an exhibition of contemporary art Jessica had once taken him to. An exciting young artist had put on an exhibition which announced that it would be about breaking down all the taboos of art. And to this end, the artist had embarked on a campaign of systematic grave robbery and had displayed the 30 most interesting results of his depredations in glass cases. The exhibit was closed after the artist sold stolen cadaver number 25 to an advertising agency for a six-figure sum, and the relatives of stolen cadaver number 25, seeing a photo of the sculpture in the Sun, had sued both for a share of the proceeds and had changed the name of the art piece to Edgar Fosbring, 1919-1987, loving husband, father and uncle, rest in peace, daddy. Richard had stared at the glass-bound corpses in their stained suits and damaged dresses with horror. He had hated himself for looking, but had not been able to turn away. Mr. Croup smiled, like a snake with a crescent moon stuck in its mouth, and his resemblance to stolen cadavers numbers 1 to 30 was, if anything, increased by this.
"What?" said the smiling Mr. Croup. "No, mister, I'm so clever and know everything Marquis. No, ooh, didn't I tell you? Whoops, I can't go upstairs, Hunter."
He paused for dramatic effect. There was something of the rotted ham about Mr. Croup.
"So paint me grey and call me a dire wolf if it isn't two little lost lambs out on their own after dark."
"You could call me a wolf, too, Mr. Croup," said Mr. Vandermeer, helpfully.
Mr. Croup clambered down from his plinth.
"A gentle word in your woolly ears, little lambkins," he said.
Richard looked around them. There had to be somewhere they could run. He reached down, clasped Dor's hand, looked around desperately.
"No, please stay just where you are," said Mr. Croup. "We like you like that, and we don't want to have to hurt you."
"We do," said Mr. Vandermeer.
"Well, yes, Mr. Vandermeer, once you put it like that, we want to hurt you both. We want to hurt you rather a lot. But that's not why we're here right now. We're here to make things more interesting. You see, when things get dull, my partner and I become restive, and hard as you may find this to believe, we lose our sunny and delightful dispositions."
Mr. Vandermeer showed them his teeth, demonstrating his sunny and delightful disposition. It was, unquestionably, the most horrible thing that Richard had ever seen.
"Leave us alone," said Dor.
Her voice was clear and steady. Richard squeezed her hand. If she could be brave, so could he.
"If you want to hurt her," he said, "you'll have to kill me first."
Mr. Vandermeer seemed genuinely pleased by this.
"All right," he said. "Thanks."
"And we'll hurt you, too," said Mr. Croup.
"Not yet, though," said Mr. Vandermeer.
You see, explained Mr. Croup in a voice like rancid butter, right now, we're just here to worry you. Mr. Vandemar's voice was a night wind blowing over a desert of bones. Make you suffer, he said. Spoil your day. Mr. Croup sat down at the base of Mr. Vandemar's plinth.
You visited Earl's Court today, he said,
in what Richard suspected he fondly imagined were light and conversational tones. So? Said Dor. She was edging away from them now. Mr. Croup smiled.
How did we know that? How did we know where to find you now?
Can get to you any time at all, said Mr. Vandemar, almost in a whisper.
You've been sold out, little ladybird,
said Mr. Croup to Dor, and Richard realized to Dor alone.
There's a traitor in your nest. A cuckoo.
Come on, she said, and she ran. Richard ran with her through the hall filled with junk toward a door. At Dor's touch, it opened.
Bid them farewell, Mr. Vandemar,
said Mr. Croup's voice from behind them.
Bye-bye, said Mr. Vandemar.
No, no, corrected Mr. Croup. Au revoir.
He made a noise then, the
cuckoo, cuckoo,
that a cuckoo might make if it were 5.5 feet high and had a weakness for human flesh. While Mr. Vandemar, truer to his nature, threw back his bullet head and howled like a wolf, ghostly and feral and mad. They were outside in the open air at night, running down a sidewalk in Bloomsbury's Russell Street. Richard thought his heart would pound its way through his chest. A large black car went by. The British Museum was on the other side of some high black-painted railings. Discreet concealed lights illuminated the outside of the high white Victorian building, the huge pillars of the facade, the steps up to the front door. This was the repository of so many of the world's treasures looted and found and rescued and donated over hundreds of years. They reached a gate in the railings. Dor grabbed it with both hands and pushed against it. Nothing happened.
Can't you make it open? Asked Richard. What does it look like I'm trying to do?
She snapped back, an unfamiliar edge to her voice. A few hundred feet down the pavement, at the main gate, large cars were drawing up. Couples in smart clothes were climbing out, walking along the drive toward the museum.
Down there, said Richard. The main gate.
Dor nodded. She looked behind them. Those two don't seem to be following us, she said. They hurried toward the main gate.
Are you all right?
Asked Richard.
What happened just then?
Dor hunched deep into her leather jacket. She was looking paler than usual, which was extremely pale indeed, and there were dark semicircles beneath her eyes.
I'm tired, she said flatly. Opened too many doors today. Takes a lot out of me each time. I need a little time to recover. Something to eat and I'll be fine.
There was a guard on the gate, minutely examining the engraved invitations that each of the well-shaven men in dinner jackets and the fragrant women in evening dresses needed to present, then ticking their names off on a list before allowing them through. A uniformed policeman beside him surveyed the guests implacably. Richard and Dor walked through the gate, and no one glanced at them twice. There was a line of people standing on the stone steps that led up to the museum doors, and Richard and Dor joined the queue. A white-haired man, accompanied by a woman bravely wearing a mink coat, joined the line immediately and neatly behind them. A thought struck Richard.
"Can they see us?"
he asked. Dor turned to the gentleman behind them in the line. She stared up at him. "Hello," she said.
The man looked around, a puzzled expression on his face, as if he was unsure what had attracted his attention. Then he caught sight of Dor, standing just in front of him. Hello, he said. I'm Dor, she told him. This is Richard. Oh, said the man. Then he fumbled in an inner pocket, pulled out a cigar case, and forgot all about them. There, see? Said Dor. I think so, he replied. They said nothing for some time as the queue moved slowly toward the single open glass door at the museum's main entrance. Dor looked at the writing on her scroll as if she needed to reassure herself of something. Then Richard said, "A traitor?" They were just winding us up, said Dor, trying to upset us.
Doing a bloody good job of it, too, said Richard.
And they walked through the open door, and then they were in the British Museum. Mr. Vandemar was hungry, so they walked back through Trafalgar Square.
Scare her,
muttered Mr. Croup disgustedly.
Scare her, that we should be brought to this.
Mr. Vandemar had found half a prawn and lettuce sandwich in a waste bin, and was gently tearing it into small pieces, which he was tossing down onto the flagstones in front of him, attracting a small flock of peckish late-night pigeons.
"Should have followed my idea," said Mr. Vandemar. "Would have scared her lots more if I'd pulled his head off while she wasn't looking, then put my hand up through his throat and wiggled my fingers about. They always scream," he confided, "when the eyeballs fall out."
He demonstrated with his right hand, stabbing up with his fingers and then wiggling them about. Mr. Croup was having none of it.
"Why get so squeamish at this stage in the game?" he asked.
"I'm not squeamish, Mr. Croup," said Vandemar. "I like it when the eyeballs fall out. Peepers and terrywags."
More grey pigeons out past their bedtime strutted over to peck the fragments of bread and prawn, and to disdain the lettuce.
"Not you," said Mr. Croup. "The governor. Kill her, kidnap her, scare her. Why doesn't he make up his mind?"
Mr. Vandemar had run out of the sandwich he had been using as bait, and now he made a dash into the crowd of pigeons who took to the wing with some clacking noises and the occasional grumbling coo.
"Well caught, Mr. Vandemar,"
said Mr. Croup approvingly. Mr. Vandemar was holding a surprised and upset pigeon, which grumbled and fidgeted in his grasp and pecked ineffectually at his fingers. Mr. Croup sighed dramatically.
"Well, anyway, we've certainly put the cat amongst the pigeons now,"
he said, with relish. Mr. Vandemar held the pigeon up to his face. There was a crunching noise as he bit off its head and commenced to chew. The security guards were directing the museum's guests to a hallway that seemed to be functioning as some kind of holding area. Dor ignored the guards entirely and set off into the museum halls with Richard trailing along behind her. They went through the Egyptian rooms, up several flights of back stairs, and into a room marked Early English.
"According to this scroll thingy," she said, "the Angelus is in this room somewhere."
Then Dor looked down at her scroll some more and looked around the hall more carefully. She made a face. "Oh," she explained, and took off back down the stairs the way they had come. Richard had an intense feeling of déjà vu before realizing that, yes, of course this felt familiar. It was how he had spent his weekends in the Jessica days, which was starting to seem, already, like things that had happened to someone else a long, long time ago.
The Angelus wasn't in that room then?
Asked Richard.
No, it wasn't there,
said Dor a little more fiercely than Richard felt the question had actually warranted.
Oh, he said, I only wondered.
They went into another room. Richard wondered if he was starting to hallucinate from a surfeit of Earl's Court sugar or from sensory deprivation. "I can hear music," he said.